Jacksonville's HRO and the T in the LGBT acronym. A closer look just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, the stories of this area's transgender residents. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, sobering statistics on domestic violence for Duval County and what's being done about it. Plus, Jack Symphony conductor Courtney Lewis previewing this weekend's opening of the season for the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, we've got a quick update on the search for the lost ship El Faro. The CEO of the ship's owner said late Monday night that he takes responsibility for the disaster that may have killed all 33 crew members aboard. Now, the search continues today for the crew of the cargo ship that set sail from Jacksonville last week right into the maw of Hurricane Joaquin. Our own Morning Edition host Michelle Corum has been covering the tragedy for WJCT and NPR and joins us. Michelle, you've been speaking with national maritime expert Rod Sullivan. He is of the belief, isn't he, that the ship should have been retired. What do we know about the tragedy so far this morning?
Well, Rod Sullivan was saying that the ship is about 40 years old, and it had some revamping done to it. It also was very seaworthy. But, of course, there are questions by a lot of people about whether it can withstand such a hurricane force as was coming at it from Hurricane Joaquin. So there are questions about the stability of the ship. There are also questions about the judgment of the captain in taking the course that he took. All this is still starting to be discussed a lot by especially family members. And now the NTSB is on the scene looking into it as well.
Right. Congresswoman Karine Brown saying she will call for a congressional investigation. 17 of those crew members are from Jacksonville. And it looks as though the ship had taken on water and had lost proportion, so they had trouble pumping out a flooded area. At least that's the speculation, Michelle.
Right. It had lost propulsion. It was starting to list. It was taking on water. I've heard some reports that, you know, the crew would be at that point trying to get rid of any water. They'd be probably working very fast. But if a big enough wave or something came to make those containers slide and topple the ship, it would be a whole different story and difficult, not enough time maybe even to get into those life suits.
Well, we so appreciate you joining us. You filed stories all weekend for NPR on this, our own Morning Edition host, Michelle Corum. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Back in 2012, the Jacksonville City Council failed by one vote to update the city's human rights ordinance to include the city's LGBT community. One of the sticking points included the T in the LGBT acronym for transgender. Some council members reportedly didn't want the ordinance language to mention six words that included gender, identity, or expression. Folio Weekly profiles some members of the local transgender community this month, and right now we're sharing their stories as well. As we welcome Jake Moore, UNF Program Coordinator for the LGBT Resource Center. Hi, Jake. Good morning.
Good morning.
Cynthia Roy is here, a transgender woman and tattoo artist. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Folio Weekly writer Claire Goforth, who profiles them in the publication. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
And when it comes to the lived experience of transgender people on the First Coast, what are your questions and thoughts? Get on the phone now. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And as Jake and Cynthia tell their stories in just a moment, first, Claire, let's begin with you. Why did you decide to write this piece?
Well, I've always been interested in issues of equality and social justice. And a few months back when I was doing some research for the story about the untested rape kits, I happened upon a cold case file picture on JSO's website of a transgender activist named Terrianne Summers who was murdered in 2001. I did a little bit of searching, and it turns out that Terrianne had been protesting the firing of a Winn-Dixie employee for cross-dressing in his spare time, and an individual that I was familiar with, Carrington Mead, knew Terrianne. So through that research, I felt that we could use this as a platform to explore issues of transgender equality and protections in our current climate.
Jake, you lead UNF's LGBT Resource Center. The data is overwhelming that transgender people are at greater risk for violence, not just in this city, but all over the country.
Definitely. Even myself, I've had experiences going into restrooms where I've been completely uncomfortable or approached by other people, confronted almost. And it's, you know, scary for a lot of trans folk to even use the restroom, go to work,
When you say confronted how? What happens?
I went into the restroom one time in Daytona in a Target and ended up, when I went to leave the restroom, was blocked in the door. Somebody was standing there. I went to leave and I looked up and there's a big 6 foot tall guy standing there taking up the whole space in the door. So what I did was just squeeze around him and exited as quickly as possible. And when I was leaving Target, right after that, because I was, in fear that something was going to happen, security was going quite quickly towards the restroom.
Someone had called security because you were in the restroom.
Correct.
Okay. And that's not the only time that happened to you?
That's the only time in the restroom that I've had that specific, security called. However, I've had a lot of instances where people have made comments in the restroom, et cetera.
And we're discussing the stories of transgender people on the show right now at 549-2937. Cynthia Roy, let's share your story. Tell us about yourself.
Okay. Well, I've been legally female now for about 4 years. I've been in Jacksonville for about 20 years. And I've seen the community change a lot. I've did a lot of cross-dressing 20 years ago when I first moved here. And I was afraid to just, leave my house pretty much. But I would have to say that the Jacksonville... the community has gotten a little better and accepting of transgender people, but we still have a long way to go. We can see it in the news and in the newspapers and even, at UNF, we see it all the time.
What do you see?
Getting harassed by people. I fear for life in certain parts of town. I used to go to, frequent certain bars or establishments all the time, and now it's a totally different feeling.
Where would you not go?
There is certain, it's kind of weird. I was a straight male before, and I was out at bars all the time. And now I have this weird, phobia of straight men, especially if they've been drinking, because, they'll flirt, and then I'll be honest with them and say, excuse me, you probably don't want anything to do with me, but let's be honest with you, I'll tell you. And then I'll out myself for the safety, and they'll get angry and... have a couple more drinks and they get angrier and their friends make fun of them because they, addressed a transgender woman. And then by the end of the night, they're giving me dirty looks and I'm afraid to walk out to my car.
What do you think it is about trans people that makes other people angry?
I don't know. I think that they're just confused that how, especially with trans women, I think that people are like, well, you used to be a man. And they don't kind of see this. They don't get the holistic approach of what it means to be transgender.
Yeah, and a lot of people said that it was particularly difficult for transgender women. And Jake, I believe, theorized in our conversation that that may be because people view men who transition to women as foregoing male privilege and accepting a lower status in society.
Do you feel that, Cynthia? Do you think men, straight guys, look at you and think, well, why on earth would you want to give up being a guy to be a girl? Do you think that's what they're thinking?
I know a lot of people who have thought that and have admitted that to me, because I've had people saying, just the opposite, talking about a transgender guy, like, congratulations, welcome. They don't say the words, but, welcome to the male population. I've had a lot of people say that, why would you want to, not the words degress, but I know that's crossing their mind.
What about the HRO, Jake? The city council under new mayor Lenny Curry is expected to at some point take that matter up again. Various advocacy groups are encouraging them to vote on it again. Will your group, the LGBT Resource Center, be pressing the case?
Yeah, we're definitely supportive of an all-inclusive, LGBT-inclusive human rights ordinance. UNF in general is. People like John Delaney, the president of the university, have expressed their support. Local businesses, as well as a lot of faith organizations, have expressed their support.
What would you say to people listening who watched the whole drama unfold back in 2012 and were opposed to the update and just were not convinced that the language update was needed? Don't believe that there is discrimination. Don't understand the need for the change.
Discrimination does exist. I think that I'm lucky because I do work at UNF, and we do have protections for LGBT individuals. So at my job currently, I can't be fired for being transgender. However, if I were to leave UNF and go to a different institution to work, I wouldn't be able to be guaranteed that same privilege.
Cynthia.
It's right. I've heard the phrase, the house that I live in right now is owned, but if I was renting and my landlord did not approve of me being trans, I could literally be kicked out. And I think that's completely insane. And same thing, you know, with jobs and stuff. I work at a very safe place like Jake does, and I'm not in danger of losing my job, but there's a lot of other people are out there, and why would we get kicked out of our apartments or lose our jobs just because we are who we are? We're law-abiding citizens just like everyone else.
And those who have jobs are fortunate, but those who do not, it can be very difficult to find employment. One individual I interviewed, Cam, who asked that his last name not be shared, spoke of going on interview after interview. And although they liked his work before the interview, after the interview, he never heard back. And it was when Cam started passing as male that he was able to actually find employment.
549-2937, what are your thoughts and questions about this city's transgender community? Jeremy on the West Side. Hi, Jeremy. Good morning. Hey, Jeremy, you're on the air.
Oh, it's Jimmy.
Oh, Jimmy. Sorry, Jimmy. Good morning.
That's okay. How you doing, Melissa? I've got a question, and the reason why I'm asking is because me and my wife, we was at the clothing store, and we saw an 18-year-old kid and his mom come in. It was a boy, and he was picking out female shoes. And my wife said, well, he's transgender. Well, the question I want to ask is, what exactly is the definition for transgender? Because when I was coming up, I mean, I'm in my 50s, and when I was coming up, transgender means people that was the opposite sex on the inside, so they went through physical augmentation to get changed into how they felt on the inside. Is that still the case, or what is the definition of transgender? I'll take my answer off there.
Thanks. All right, thanks, Jimmy. Jake Moore.
So the definition of transgender is when somebody's gender identity or how they feel inside doesn't match the sex that they were assigned at birth. This could be that they are opposite, you know, identifying completely opposite as female to male or male to female. But this could also mean that they identify somewhere that's not male or female.
Do you think Caitlyn Jenner's very public transition helped educate people and raise awareness about the transgender community? Do you think it was a helpful journey for people to watch unfold?
Helpful, yes, in some ways, and somewhat harmful in others.
Okay.
I am glad that Ms. Jenner came out and she's finally, you know, being herself, and I'm proud of her for that. As being what people see her as a spokesperson, for the trans community, that is a very bad thing.
She's not typical.
Correct.
She's in terms of being very privileged, having a lot of resources. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, you know, she did the big interview saying, you know, I'm coming out. And then a month later, she was on the cover of that magazine and looking beautiful. And, you know, nobody can do that kind of transition in a couple months without, you know, lots of makeup artists and Photoshop and all that stuff. And a lot of girls that I was mentoring came to me very upset. They're like, you know, I've been on my HRT, hormone replacement therapy, for, you know, a year now. And, you know, Miss Jenner's been on it for, what, 2-3 weeks, and she's beautiful. And I had to prove to them that, you know, that was a lot of Photoshop.
And millions of dollars in surgery,
oh,
too.
Yeah. If there's no real proof that she has had surgery, but we
can...
Well,
the facial feminization surgery, yeah.
Facial feminization surgery,
sure. Yep. Yeah.
But the rest of it, she would not have been able to wear that corset in that photo shoot if she had top surgery. She would not be walking around in those heels on the red carpet if she had bottom surgery. So... she is still, there's a lot of old religious beliefs saying that you have to do what you're doing for a year and a day before you can be considered full and whole and ready to go. And Miss Jenner is still in her caves coming out, definitely.
Jim in Riverside. Hi, Jim. Good morning. What are your thoughts?
Yes, I have a anecdote that happened here in the city in a public building. It shows how difficulties with transgender discrimination has actually affected other members of the public. There was a woman that works at the building department at the Ball Building downtown, and was in the bathroom, and a transgender member of the community was in the bathroom also, and because of her lack of understanding or what have you, she panicked and went and complained to her supervisor, and as a result of that complaint, no one can use any of the bathrooms. The members of the public cannot use the bathrooms in the Ball Building anywhere unless you have an employee ID card that you have to swipe through the gate. So no one that come, no matter how much money you want to spend at a public building pulling permits or what have you, you're banned from going to the bathroom there because one employee had a lack of understanding and their supervisor was allowed to use this instance to lock down all the bathrooms in the Ball Building. And I think that's a problem not just for one segment of the community, but the whole community.
Jim, thanks for the call. Claire, the issue involving bathrooms seems to come up time and again, and it very well may come up when the debate over the HRO resurfaces with the city council. The argument that this presents an issue for people that are uncomfortable going into bathrooms. What about this argument and the attendant issues?
I mean, this argument, I just feel, fails immediately. I mean, if you can be uncomfortable in a bathroom for many reasons. A trans person being in the bathroom shouldn't be one of them. It is realistic it is extremely unrealistic that you would ever be victimized by a trans person in a bathroom if that is the fear. If the fear is that a person who is sexually attracted to you is in the bathroom with you at the same time is the basis for it, that also fails logically because we have an LGB community that uses whichever restroom because they're cisgender. No one has a question about it. You know, it's unfortunate this issue keeps coming up again and again over something that's very personal and really has nothing to do with the other people. And I realize my views are extremely progressive on this, but I mean, just yesterday, Hobby Lobby was forced by a court to stop discriminating against one of their transgender employees in the bathroom.
And how so?
They were requiring her to use a bathroom that was quite a distance away, wasn't allowing her to use the bathroom that the female bathroom. She identifies as female.
And can you explain for listeners that might not be aware what the term cisgender means?
Cisgender is a person who identifies as the biological gender they were assigned at birth.
Gina is on the line now from Orlando. Hi, Gina. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Gina Duncan. I'm the Transgender Inclusion Director for Equality Florida. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make a point in reference to the patchwork approach that is occurring in Florida in reference to the human rights ordinances. In my role with Equality Florida, I travel the state, and it's a very interesting dynamic that in Orlando and in Orange County, where I live, we have passed a fully inclusive human rights ordinance. I often travel to Jacksonville. The dynamic of entering Jacksonville knowing that I now have less rights and protections simply by traveling 2 hours is something that we absolutely need to address. You know, there's a need to eliminate the patchwork approach to our anti-discrimination ordinances And, of course, passed its fully inclusive human rights ordinance in Jacksonville. Someone's rights should not change based on where they live, where they work, or they travel.
Gina, you're with Equality Florida. Since in 2012, the measure went down by one vote, 10-9, and some council members said they were okay with updating the ordinance to cover gays and lesbians, but felt uncomfortable with the phrase gender identity and expression. In other words, we're not comfortable with the transgender element of updating the ordinance. Will you take an incremental approach as you advocate on this issue again with the new city council, or will you push for a fully inclusive measure?
We absolutely will only push for a fully inclusive human rights ordinance. And it's important that to note that the transgender community experiences perhaps the highest rate of discrimination and violence of any demographic. And due to the discrimination stresses, we experienced a 41% attempted suicide rate within the transgender community. It's important that, you know, any legislation include the entire LGBT community.
Gina, tell us a little bit more about your organization's approach here on the ground in Jacksonville. It's the largest major metro in America without an updated human rights ordinance, which has been brought up time and again. New Mayor Curry has promised a community-wide conversation about this issue. How will Equality Florida be part of that?
Well, we believe in, obviously, a fully inclusive human rights ordinance, and we're currently working diligently and have been for years to pass a statewide ordinance called the Competitive Workforce Act, which would be a statewide anti-discrimination law. In the meantime, working with many allies and involved advocates, we've been able to pass, at this point, 34 fully inclusive human rights ordinances across the state. And at this point, almost 60% of our citizens, all citizens, are fully protected in areas of employment, housing, and public accommodations. You know, and I think where we also see a societal shift is with our major employers. You know, corporate America honestly fully supports fully inclusive policies. And in my role with Equality Florida, I travel the state doing transgender inclusion workshops. And major employers, including employers in Jacksonville, have implemented fully inclusive diversity platforms in their firms. And they believe that, you know, all cities in which their employees live should also provide protection against discrimination in these areas.
You know what I would...
Thank you. That's Gina on the line from Orlando representing Equality Florida. Thanks for calling in, Gina. Claire, go forth.
I would like to add to that the fact that in spite of Jacksonville lacking an HRO, we have the highest percentage of LGBT citizens of any city in Florida. 4.3% of the city is LGBT, which actually translates to about 36,000 LGBT members of the community, which is roughly equivalent to the size of a city council district.
Right, which is an interesting... turn of affairs. So, Jake Moore, your final thoughts, and Cynthia, you as well. Jake.
I would say that my final thoughts are nobody should be fired or discriminated against based upon anything but their job performance. They should be able to use the restroom that they identify with, and they should be able to live their lives at home, take care of their families, just based on wanting to live out that American dream.
I want to go back real quick about two callers ago. You said the person with the restrooms, that person was uninformed of what it's like to be transgender. Thank you for using that term. And I want to close with that that's just it. A lot of people fear what they don't know. And so if we inform and educate and give out trans awareness, let people know that transgender people are normal people that work in colleges and have normal businesses and own houses and we're regular people, maybe they will be educated and informed instead of afraid.
Thanks, all three of you, for being with us.
And please do pick up your folio weekly tomorrow on newsstands.
Claire Goforth writes for Folio. We were also joined by Jake Moore, UNF Program Coordinator for the LGBT Resource Center, and also joining us Cynthia Roy, local resident and transgender woman, and much more still to come later. Don't miss it as symphony conductor Courtney Lewis steps into Studio 5, a preview of the orchestra's opening of the fall season this weekend. But up next, sobering numbers on domestic violence in Duval County are released. What's being done about it? That's after this.
Mexican-American writer Sandra Cisneros has spent her life crossing borders, and crossing borders helped her create connections.
Who better to travel between these two worlds than those of us who are mixed race or mestizos?
A conversation with the author of A House of My Own later on All Things Considered from NPR News. Weekdays at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, according to a new report recently released by Hubbard House and the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, 18 murders in Duval County last year were the result of domestic violence. Roughly 5,000 incidents of domestic violence have been reported in Duval so far this year. October marks Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Gail Payton is the Chief Operating Officer for Hubbard House, and she joins us now with more about raising awareness and about those sobering numbers, Gail. Good morning. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Melissa.
So the crime report for Duval County looks at overall crime numbers, but domestic violence numbers as well. And we've got a problem in Duval County. We've known this for some time when it comes to intimate partner violence.
Definitely. There is a problem. If you look at the statistics, this past year was really the killing fields, if to use that phrase, because there was approximately an 83% increase from 2013 to 2014 in domestic violence homicides. That's unacceptable. People are dying at the hands of somebody who says that they love them.
And there are a number of factors driving this dynamic. Can you talk about some of those? Because Hubbard House, of course, one of the premier shelters and resources for not only women, but mainly women that are seeking help. Let's talk about some of the complex factors driving intimate partner domestic violence.
There are a lot of factors that play into that. The thing that the mortality review report that came out that you were talking about showed that for the first time there was an overwhelming number of suspects who had mental health issues in their history. Last year it was 45% of the people. Prior 17 years combined, it was less than 30%. That's a huge discrepancy of what's going on. So we really recommend that mental health professionals screen for domestic violence when they're providing services. And for those people that are in relationships where there is a person who has a mental health issue who is also a suspect of domestic violence, that they really need to be aware that their lethality and their risk for homicide has increased.
It all comes back to mental health. So many problems in this community come back to that central issue, don't they?
They do. And unfortunately, in Florida, we received 49th for funding, and Jacksonville has the lowest funding in the state.
Right.
That's abysmal.
Now, 73% of the deaths occurred after the couple had separated.
Yes, and that's something that people don't understand. You'll often hear people ask victims of domestic violence, or they'll ask us as professionals in the field, why doesn't she just leave?
Well, that can be the most dangerous time for the victim as well as the children, because that's when the escalation of the violence occurs, and that's when we see a large portion of homicides occurring.
And it has to do with a loss of control, usually, right? There are deep-seated control dynamics going on here.
Exactly. A loss of control. The perpetrator believes that the victim is their property, and if they're gone, they don't have access to them. They don't have the ability to, as you said, control what they're doing, who they're seeing. And so oftentimes you'll hear them say phrases like, if I can't have you, nobody will, and that's when a person hears that, they really need to take that serious, because what we have found through the research is that is the time and that is a phrase that can lead to death.
Here are some data points from the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Every 9 seconds, a woman in this country is assaulted or beaten. One in three women, mm-hmm. and one in four men have been physically abused by an intimate partner. The presence of a gun in the home increases the risk of domestic violence homicide by 500%. Domestic violence most common among young women between the ages of 18 and 24.
Exactly.
That's not surprising.
No, it's not. You're talking about women in childbearing years when they're getting into some formal and stronger relationships that you're seeing this come about. And additionally, if you look at those statistics, the overwhelming problem that we're running into is that violence against women is really still exists, is still a real factor. And what we found in the fatality report this year, all of the suspects this year were men, and all of the victims, the majority of the victims were women. So if you're working with women who are in a relationship that's abusive, it's really important to help them understand how lethal that situation can be and to safety plan with them and to give them options.
And finding a way out economically is so difficult. To mark Domestic Violence Awareness Month, the Purple Purse campaign is trying to help women become economically empowered, because often one of the reasons women stay is they don't have the money to leave.
Exactly.
Can you let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, that is one of the biggest barriers to leaving an abusive relationship is economics. So particularly if women have children, if their choice is to live on the streets or to live in a home where there's violence, they will typically live in the home and at least provide a roof over their heads for their kids. When people don't make a living wage, they're not able to provide for housing or food. You know, the costs of housing are astronomical. And to be able to afford housing, a lot of victims can't do that on what they make. To be able to afford childcare if you're going to live on your own, think of the cost that you pay for childcare. It's really unreasonable. So you put all these economic factors together, and mm-hmm. a person can literally be trapped in an abusive relationship.
So how does Hubbard House try to help, besides providing a shelter for women? And
well,
their kids.
Right. In addition to providing a shelter, we have a career advocacy program that we call COACH, Creating Opportunities and Career Help. And it's funded by the COACH Foundation. And we help women get jobs. We help them either get jobs or get raises so that they can sustain their livelihood and sustain their families. In addition to that, we provide mental health counseling for victims of domestic violence to help them heal from the trauma they've been involved with. And we have support groups, and we have housing options where we link up with others in the community to get people into affordable housing.
And they can all, and you can always use the public's help in terms of volunteering, donations, and coming up on October 22nd, a special event.
Yes, it's our annual Barbara Ann Campbell Memorial Breakfast. That's where we raise awareness in the community about domestic violence, and it's in honor of former Mayor Godbold's sister-in-law who unfortunately died at the hands of her husband. And it's also an opportunity to learn about the work that we're doing and to hear from victims firsthand how they have overcome being in these situations.
That's coming up on October 22nd, so try to mark your calendar for that. The hashtag on Twitter is #WhyIStandUp. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Gail Payton, Chief Operating Officer for Hubbard House, a vital resource in this community. And thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
Back in a moment.
on the next Fresh Air, Chef Michael Solomonov talks about creating modern Israeli cuisine for Americans and describes what it was like before he was sober when he was running a restaurant while addicted to drugs. He co-founded the Philadelphia restaurant Zahav and has a new cookbook called Zahav, A World of Israeli Cooking. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Life has enough drama.
Seems we've gotten a bad batch of grits, and we think it comes from Minnesota. They've made everyone feel gloomy and guilty.
Oh, and reality.
Can we not do this? Can we just not do this?
I'm going to have a practice funeral. All right?
Find a way to forget your troubles.
With ping pong, trap shooting, hopscotch.
And gather some friends around the radio this weekend.
A Prairie Home Companion, returning Saturdays at 6.
Welcome back. Well, the First Coast Connect Book Club returns later this month with a discussion of writer David McCullough's biography of the Wright brothers. You can check out a free copy of the book from the Jacksonville Public Library. They're our partner for the book club. You can also buy a copy at Chamberlain's or the Book Mine. They're our partners, too. And then send us your thoughts about the Wright brothers to bookclub@wjct.org. Be part of our on-air book club discussion. You can find out more about the book club at wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Well, whether it's outrage over mass shootings, concern over how we deal with the issue of homelessness, or the problem of domestic violence that we just talked about, our country's mental health system is a pressing problem here on the First Coast as well. Jacksonville University is responding to the exploding demand for better services with a new program. It's this region's only hybrid-style mental health counseling master's degree. Here to tell us more, we welcome program co-director Dr. Larry Wagner and Dr. Lynette Kennison, associate professor of nursing, both with JU. And thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Wagner, let's begin with you. This is a unique hybrid program, and there's also an affiliation with Baptist Health, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. So what's this all about? How did this come together?
Well, it came out of some collegial dialogue and in a sense, beginning to look at cutting-edge ways to get into the need that we feel like is going to be right in the very near future, hoping that our legislature and our governor will come about with more contribution, more money. But this is also very much suited for individuals that are working while trying to pursue a transition to specialized degrees or a transition in life. And it gives them a chance to be able to do some very quality on-campus face-to-face work with the professors and their peers, but also have time to be able to keep their jobs, do online kinds of projects, discussion boards, community connections, and be able to have a very rich kind of interaction. It's a cohort group, so they get the chance to stay with the same group of peers throughout their two-year experience.
Excellent. And Dr. Kennison, this Master of Science in Mental Health Counseling will enable graduates to treat depression, anxiety, behavioral disorders, addiction, and other issues so important here in Florida, where we have a big problem and a lot of people not getting the help that they need, clearly.
Absolutely. The other program that Jacksonville University is beginning is a nurse practitioner program for mental health psychiatric nursing. And in that program, our students will be able to prescribe medications in order to treat some of these disorders that people experience, which is also extremely important.
This really, I think, is slated to make such a powerful impact in this community, Dr. Wagner, and part of the Applied Health Sciences emphasis on the JU campus, it seems, as well.
Yes, yes. And we're hoping that, you know, there are many professionals that would venture out into mental health if they had the time and the resources to do so, to gain knowledge, to be able to have more on-hands kind of effect. And one of the things that this program does is that it adds on a focus in marriage and family and couples and relational and systemic kinds of ways of dealing with issues. So we're not looking at just pathology and responding to diagnosis. We're looking at how to enrich families, mm-hmm. how to make relationships more profound, how to promote flexibility and creativity as people move about our community.
And Dr. Kennison, you'll be drawing students who come from a variety of undergraduate backgrounds, correct?
For the psychiatric nurse practitioner program, we will be drawing students that are already nurses, that have a baccalaureate in nursing, as well as we will be drawing students who are family nurse practitioners who actually wanted to specialize in mental health nursing. Mm-hmm. We've had quite a our psychiatrists in the community have really asked for more psychiatric nurse practitioners to extend access to care.
Jacksonville has really risen to the challenge, it seems, lately, all across the board in looking at this issue of mental health, whether it's JCCI, they're in our building, and their mental health inquiry, Baptist Health, funding a behavioral health wing, and lots of players are looking at this now. JU is just the latest. It's become a community imperative, would you say, yes. Dr. Wagner, to try yes. to do a better job of figuring out how we deal with this issue?
Yes. I mean, very, very minimal estimation is that one in four of us in the United States have some kind of mental health challenge. And more than half of those are not even diagnosed or treated at all. And that is a staggering kind of statistic.
And so the admissions deadline for the Master of Science in Clinical Mental Health Counseling is coming, or actually it's already passed.
No.
Is that right?
November 1st.
November 1st. So you're going to have some new students pretty soon here. How exciting is that?
It's very exciting. Our psychiatric nurse practitioner program, we actually have our first group that started this August, and we are adding some more students who are already nurse practitioners to begin the summer.
Very exciting. Well, kudos to both of you. It is a much-needed and prestigious new academic offering on the Jacksonville University campus. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
Dr. Larry Wagner and Dr. Lynette Kennison, both with Jacksonville University, the only hybrid-style mental health counseling master's degree now being offered on the JU campus. And in a moment, symphony conductor Courtney Lewis.
On the next episode of WJCT's Hometown, explore Jackson's Night Market, sample the Candy Apple Cafe, get to know the volunteers in medicine, look back with the First Presbyterian Church of Jacksonville, and commune with the Jesse Ball DuPont Center. WJCT's Hometown, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to bring me, Michael Feldman, and my show, What Do You Know?, to the Florida Theater in Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy the southern winter just a little bit. You bring the sunshine, I'll bring the sunscreen. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
Listeners love Relax Radio.
Hi, I'm Evan Willman. I typically listen to the station when I'm in my home office. I work out of my house a lot. I have my HD radio in there. So this is really the best of all worlds. It gives me my news. It gives me music that constantly delights and surprises me.
When you make a $120 gift to WJCT, you'll receive an HD radio so you can tune in to Relax. Call 904-353-9528 for more information.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, lots of excitement at Jacoby Hall as the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra prepares to celebrate the opening of its season with three concerts this weekend. In his first official appearance as music director, conductor Courtney Lewis will lead the orchestra's performance of Adam's Short Ride in a Fast Machine, Haydn's Symphony No. 90, and Holst's The Planets. Courtney Lewis, welcome to the studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. It's great to be back.
Great to have you. You're such a celebrity around town, and I'm sure it will be a packed house this weekend, so kudos. Let's talk about these selections. Holst the Planets, I guess the planetarium mosh is going to be part of this. Is that right?
Yes, it's a very exciting collaboration for us. There are going to be lots of stalls set up in the foyer of Jacoby Hall. So if you're coming to the concert, which I really hope you will, come an hour early and you can experience interactive exhibits on each of the planets before you hear the music that host wrote to represent each planet.
That's right. He captured the astrological character of each planet in 7 different movements.
That's right.
Right.
They hadn't discovered Pluto yet when he wrote the piece.
Ah.
And there's nothing for Earth.
Oh.
So seven movements.
So, okay. So 3 different pieces of music, each has a different feel. What's it like for you as a conductor to move through those different transitions?
It's great. You know, it's these 3 pieces are very much what we want the orchestra to be about. We've got a new piece, John Adams' Short Ride in a Fast Machine from 1986. Adams described this piece as being like the experience of getting into a friend's fast sports car and then regretting that you'd taken your life in your hands on this wild ride. That's a 5-minute blockbuster kind of fanfare to the season. Then we play Haydn's 90th Symphony from 1788. There's lots of classical repertoire from the 18th century that we haven't played for a long time in Jacksonville. And this is a particularly exciting symphony because Haydn plays a lot of tricks on the audience. And one of the amazing things about this piece is that the audience never knows when it's over.
Oh, really?
So it takes you by surprise.
Oh, very cool. Now, for the opening of the symphony, people are encouraged to dress to impress. You are always dressed to the nines, so they'll be emulating you, Courtney. Is that the story here?
Well, we thought it would be fun to make this a really big celebration. So
right.
We're going to have a red carpet leading into Jacoby Hall, and we're encouraging you to get really dressed up. Lots of people are having parties before the concert to have cocktails and to make it a really special event.
Very nice. Well, you've brought a lot of style and youthful energy to the symphony. What are some of your goals for bringing younger people, bringing that sort of that new generation of excitement to the symphony? Because
mm-hmm.
people have tended to think of it as the older generation coming down to Jacoby Hall to hear the music.
Yeah. One of the most exciting things that we're doing this season is our new concert series called Symphony in 60, which is sponsored by Best Bet. And these are 3 concerts, each 60 minutes long, which are at 6 o'clock in the evening. And the idea is that you come after work before you come home and you're in and out in an hour and you hear the music. And it's going to attract, I hope, a new kind of person. There'll be cocktails on stage with the musicians afterwards. But also, we just had a really fantastic week of community concerts. We played at Unity Plaza at mm-hmm. 220 Riverside.
That was very exciting.
And we also had concerts in St. Augustine and at Jacoby Hall. And these concerts were packed this week. We filled Jacoby Hall on Saturday night for a free community concert. There were loads of young people. There were kids. There were families. So, you know, it's already beginning. We're getting new people to come in, and people are realizing that the symphony is something for everybody, not just for their grandparents.
That's right. It's for everybody. You're on social media, we need to point out. Right? The last time you were here, we gave out you're on Facebook, you're on Twitter. It's Courtney Conducts, right?
Courtney Conduct.
Courtney Conduct without the S.
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. So follow the conductor, Courtney Lewis, on Twitter. Are you on Instagram, by the way?
No, I'm not. Much to the PR team's chagrin.
Why aren't you? Our PR maven, Amy Rankin, is sitting here. She's probably tearing her hair out. Why aren't you? You're too busy, right?
Only so many hours in
yeah,
a day.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm sure that's the reason why. Well, you are busy because you're doing this, and then you travel. You have other commitments as well.
This season, I'm still the assistant conductor of the New York Philharmonic. And
right.
This season, I'm guest conducting in Hong Kong and Antwerp and Colorado Symphony next week. So I'm busy.
You're a man of the world, literally.
But it is very exciting that this year, at last, Jacksonville is home and that this is where I am the most time. It's great.
It is exciting. It is the opening of the symphony this weekend, beginning Friday, and you're giving a talk Friday, so people need to come early to hear you speak.
Yeah, we have a series called Insight, which is an hour before every concert when you can come and find out the inside story of each of the pieces that we're playing.
Get your tickets now for the opening of the new season of the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra, jacksymphony.org, with music director Courtney Lewis. So good to see you.
Lovely to see you too.
And that's our program. Thanks so much for listening. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed by the symphony's Pyotr Shevchik. Make sure to subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, California becomes the 5th state to let terminally ill patients end their lives. Supporters say this could be the tipping point for an issue that's been gaining traction across the U.S., the latest in the Aid in Dying movement. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.